Good afternoon. You're tuned into Dialogue here on WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. It's very nice to be back for my first Dialogue since I'm back here at WUOT. Today, my co-host is Todd Steed, and we have three special guests. We're going to talk about the country music scene as it was and as it still is here in Knoxville and in East Tennessee. I'm going to let everybody else introduce themselves, and we'll get the conversation started.
Hey, this is Todd, and I work at WUOT with Chrissy Kuiper.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Trisha Jean Brady, and I'm a local singer, songwriter, musician.
Hey, I'm Jack Neely. I'm director of the Knoxville History Project, and write some stuff too. But yeah,
lots of stuff.
Yeah. I'm Ernie Freeberg. I'm head of the history department here at UT.
All right. So we should start off by saying this is a pretty special version of Dialogue, in that this is kind of part of the Raised in Knoxville project. Todd has been in charge of this, and it all started with a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right. So Regina Dean, our director, came in and said, there's this grant about country music. And I said, yes, because it's something that the WUOT hasn't always dived so deeply into. We've always had country music. We've had Mountain Jubilee with Paul Campbell. Studio 865 has always had country. But I feel like because we're in East Tennessee, this was something I really, really wanted to be a part of, and the staff and everybody have been outstanding. So that's basically it. We wrote a grant proposal and waited. And while we were waiting, we started work on it because we wanted to do it either way.
Right.
And it was actually approved after the work had already, a lot of it had actually been done because we were so gung-ho on it. And it has a lot of components to it. A lot of interviews, a lot of history, podcast, and also creating music, commissioning music, which is something I don't think WUOT has ever done.
I don't think we have.
And this has been kind of an exciting part for me, is actually commission new works to be recorded and performed, and that's where Mick Harrison and Trisha Jean Brady came in.
Yeah, and we'll hear Trisha Jean's song that she did for this project later on in the show. Okay, so let's start kind of at the beginning. As we say in the promo and in the opener, there's an adage that says it was, you know, country music was born in Bristol, it was raised in Knoxville, and then it went to Nashville and did something, depending on who is telling, you know, the joke. Clearly, it has evolved as it has gone on. But I want to kind of get, set the scene and talk about what time period we're talking about as the birth of country music in East Tennessee.
Yeah, this is Jack. Of course, the Bristol sessions were very, very important, Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family especially, in 1927. But country music had been around a long, long time before that, and even had been on record before that. There had been Sturkey Brothers Furniture here in Knoxville had made recordings of buskers from downtown in New York. That was the nearest recording studio in those days, was New York. And you get on the train, sent these hobos more or less on the train to go make records. And you know, some of them, even Uncle Dave Macon was one of those early. Some of his earliest recordings were, he was from Middle Tennessee, but they were sponsored by this Knoxville company, Sturkey Brothers Furniture, because they were trying to expand the market for phonographs. Basically, phonographs had been kind of an elite thing before that. Most of the music on them was opera, and Sturkey Brothers Furniture got this idea of doing working people's music, that phonographs were cheaper, and they thought working people would buy them if they had music they liked, and I think he was right. But there was a little flourishing in like 1924, 25 of these early guys, George Renault and some of these folks who were from Knoxville who were making records up at just blind buskers, some of them, Mac and Bob, some of these people. But it goes back even before that. Of course, I love the story that country music as a performance sort of thing, as opposed to just a family thing of, you know, getting your family around and playing some old songs, as playing on stage might have started in Knoxville in 1883 as a prank on an opera festival. There was an opera festival in 1883, and it was a very big deal, and I was very proud of it. But they had I think the organizers knew about it and thought it'd be kind of a droll way to finish the festival, on a Saturday afternoon when everybody was about to go home, to come out right after the last soprano had sung in Staub's Opera House to bring out a bunch of fiddlers. And these fiddlers had a little contest on stage and played some old-time music on stage and tried to outdo each other, mostly old guys because young people liked opera. Old people liked country music. But it was but this was seemed to be the beginning of a tradition of fiddling contests on Market Square that lasted pretty much over the next 40 or 50 years. And there's a whole series of stories that we don't know about yet. And that's before it was really a big deal on radio. But radio, I guess, is part of what we'll be talking about today. And that was a whole new wave of interest in country music.
That's fascinating. I'd never heard that story about the opera.
Yeah. I love it. It's one of my favorite stories. And it's great. It was like a four-day opera festival. I think it was based on stuff they were doing in Cincinnati. And a lot of, I think it was a German immigrant who was behind that. But they had this kind of funny joke sort of at the end of the opera festival. But people really liked it. I mean, this opera, seated opera audience, stayed, most of them. I heard some of them left, but they stayed and seemed to enjoy this novelty.
Real music lovers,
I guess.
That's
right. Well, that's actually a great point, and it's something that the Ken Burns documentary that's coming out gets well into, is that the musicians and the fans themselves did not see the lines so clearly between music styles and did not associate them necessarily as listeners with race and class. So deeply as others, and so a lot of people would say, you know, why wouldn't you like opera and country?
Yeah.
I think we should, Jack, stage a fiddle competition, maybe after the next Marble City Opera performance.
Yeah. I think they would love that.
They'd probably get into it, and why wouldn't they?
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
The really cool part about that is that I've always heard that the story was at one of those, he came up and said, well, you loved the Grand Old Opera, or the Grand Opera, you're going to love the Grand Old Opry. And that's where it stuck from.
That's right.
That is where
right.
the name came from.
That was at WSM, yeah.
Definitely.
1925 or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I love that because it just really ties it all together, you know.
Well, let's go back to Bristol. Todd, you took a trip up there.
Yeah.
You saw the birthplace of country music.
Yeah, and there's a museum up there, the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, which is a wonderful thing. It's so different from any other museum because it essentially talks about a few days of work. That changed the course of music history and, in a sense, changed the course of history in the United States in a lot of ways, you know, in subtle ways. I had never been to Bristol. I was actually kind of embarrassed as a musician, never having been there. And so I was like, well,
I'll sit here and not be shocked.
I had to fix it. Oh, I mean, I've stopped at the Pilot, you know, and gotten a slushy. But you actually have to drive in. And I went to the Country Music, a Birthplace of Country Music Museum. And one of the coolest things about it, I mean, the whole thing is really cool, but there's a lot of people playing music and learning music downstairs in the museum itself. That I really loved.
Oh, okay.
But then you go upstairs and there's a whole exhibit on just one song, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And I'm watching that, and there's Trisha Jean Brady singing it.
That is an honor to be in a museum, let me say.
Wow.
Sure.
That was a deal changer.
And such a bedrock song.
Definitely.
I mean, that's, I guess, so is that part of the history then, is that it was born from gospel?
Yeah, that's one of the roots, you know, and there's all these roots that come from all of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something from Africa, there's something from Europe, and there's things that only can happen when you mix them together here. But I just love walking around Bristol and checking out the museum and talking to people. And everyone that lives there that I talk to is well aware of the Bristol sessions. That may not have been the case, you know, 30 years ago. But it's a really cool museum. And it just got me fired up. And I went and listened to the whole thing. It's a lot of recordings. And there's just some amazing music there. I know it's historic, but the music itself is quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Bristol itself, I think, put the platform there for people to then follow through and start creating on their own. You know, they had the big sessions in 27, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had the Carter family, which they considered that hearth and home music. Any kind of harmonies and song, shape note singing, they consider that hearth and home. And then they had Jimmy Rogers come in with what they really considered rhythm and blues. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really met and people took off from there. So it was happening before, but that's where they got to come together and people got recordings of it.
I was, in a former life, I was a public radio documentary producer in New England. So let me add that piece to this. I interviewed, I did a, a documentary about the early days of country music in Maine. And, you know, it's a sort of, why in Maine? There is no country music in Maine. So I talked to many people who were, these were people who were recording artists in the 30s and 40s and into the 50s. And they said, this isn't a distinctively Southern music, that this, you know, that everybody listened to Jimmy Rogers, that this sort of hearth and home music, as you're describing it, was throughout the country. You know, it was folk music, not
exactly.
Southern music.
It was brought
right?
here, yes.
And if you listen, I was listening the other day to those wonderful Knoxville Sessions recordings mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. the string band music in the 20s. And that sounds exactly like the music mm-hmm. of string bands in Maine, you know, the bad jokes and the fiddling and the, you know, it's still going today. So yeah. So it's interesting that to me that this, you know, what is it that happened at Bristol? Was there a unique concentration of elements there, or was there just a marketing thing that made that look like that was the session that...
How so?
I believe it was money. They had, as we were already hearing, they were making records, right?
Right.
So they were pressing these people that nobody had heard, and they, in particular, I can't remember his name right now, but they pressed a fiddle player, and they made about 500 copies of his album. They didn't put a label on it or anything, nothing. And they sold them all, and they realized how much revenue they could make off of them, and that's when they came mm-hmm. and started recording. Mm-hmm. It was money. I think there were preservationists that really wanted to have that happen, obviously, but the people
the
behind it
themselves.
That came and did yeah. the sessions, and that's why the artists flocked to it, because they needed money too. So it, yeah. you know.
Particularly at that time.
Of course.
I mean, you can see how, you know,
the
economy
Carter family
was.
Story, yes. I mean, yeah. they snuck in the back door of the sessions because they were embarrassed by how they looked. So they needed that money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Victor was a very big recording company, one of the three biggest, and had a big success with and Jimmy Rogers and the Carter Family,
exactly.
sounds like.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jimmy Rogers was a crossover artist in lots of ways. He did make records with Louis Armstrong. You know, he was just all over the place.
Yes.
But he was a really charismatic figure in early popular music, even if you don't call it country or whatever. He was just an early pop star. It's a very, very important stuff happened there. But I think country music had several big bangs along the way,
definitely.
Probably.
I love that we have come to the commercialization of country music, because that's going to feed right into our second segment that we're going to do after the break here on Dialogue, when we're going to talk about Ernie Freeberg's new book about Kaz Walker. Mm-hmm. So... the king of commercialism in Knoxville. So I'll let Greg take it away. This is Dialogue. It's 19 minutes after 12, and you're tuned into WUOT.